Let me begin with a couple of light-hearted stories because the thinking we're going to be doing is going to be rather heavy. The story is told of these two Australian sailors who had just disembarked from a ship in England and were walking into town that night and found their way into a pub. And they enjoyed themselves throughout the evening and had one too many, walked out of that pub into a dense London fog. Completely disoriented, they were wobbling on their feet, looking around, trying to get some help, when they saw a gentleman coming into the pub, unknown to them, was a highly decorated naval officer. And as he came closer, one of them said to him, "Say, you bloke, can you tell us where we are?" The officer, quite offended, looked at the men and said, "Do you men know who I am?" At which point one of the sailors said to the other, "We're really in a mess now. We don't know where we are, and he doesn't know who he is." Imagine, as we begin this century, we're trying to define who we are. On the other end of the spectrum is the story of the greatest, Muhammad Ali, sitting on a plane. And it hit moderate turbulence, which is a euphemism for better start performing the last rites. And as the plane was being jolted around, the captain announced to fasten their seat belts. Everybody complied except Ali. So a flight attendant went over to him and said, "Sir, would you please fasten your seat belt?" He looked at her and said, "Superman, don't need no seat belt." She looked at him and said, "Superman, don't need no airplane either." Somewhere in the spectrum of not knowing who we are and where we are, to the other end of it where we think we're Superman, somewhere in the middle, we're going to have to find the answer. Because both of these ideas in some ways contribute to the question and to the answer. And therefore to a more sobering story, true, coming out of the former Soviet Union, the year 2000, when they were releasing all of their former political prisoners. There was a Hungarian prisoner by the name of Andrei Stamas, who had been put in solitary for so long and was in a psychiatric room by himself there, treated occasionally. And they were going to execute him or do away with him when some Hungarians asked if they could come and visit him because they were told he was speaking gibberish, nonsense. And a Hungarian psychiatrist went and spent several hours with him and came out and said, "He's not talking nonsense. He's talking an old Hungarian dialect. Release him to us and we will treat him and make him well." They finally signed the papers and the psychiatrist put him into a wheelchair, was moving him out of that place. What do you think was the first thing he asked for? As he was being wheeled out, he turned to the psychiatrist and asked for the first object that he wanted to hold. It was a mirror. He had not seen himself in 55 years. And when they held the mirror in front of him, he put his face in his hands and sobbed uncontrollably. When you've seen your face at age 20, and next time you see your face at age 75, after being bullied, pummeled, humiliated, dehumanized, you and I would break into sobs as well. If the mere need of a mirror is so important to us in the morning, we check ourselves to make sure we've taken care of all these innocent forms of disfiguration before we move out. Come back at the end of the day and look at ourselves again. What must it be like for a man after 5 decades of his life, or a woman after 5 decades of her life, to not know precisely what you look like or what you are intended to look like? I want to present to you the Judeo-Christian worldview. Obviously, not everybody here will agree with what I'm going to say, but the Judeo-Christian worldview looks at humanity as a paradigm. This is a worldview. When you ask one question, it refers to the paradigm itself. And that the question must be raised, is this paradigm meeting the tests of truth? From two tests of truth and their vantage points, the test of correspondence, where individual questions meet particular answers, and the test of coherence, where the totality of the answers hold together in a tightly knit skin of argument. So you've got both the correspondence theory at work here and the coherence theory at work here. And what I want to do is present to you how it is that we bring to bear this paradigm. Because if you really put it alongside other paradigms, whether you take the Marxist one or the Freudian one or the Sartrean one or the Huxley model or the Joseph Fletcher model, when you take all of these so-called humanistic frameworks of reference and you put them alongside each other, you find out that there really are some fundamental points of tension between them, and the reason being there is no ontological point of reference for the paradigm. It emerges from within themselves. So Sartre would challenge what Freud would say. Freud would be challenged by the Platonic view of man, who had a completely different way of looking at the ultimate reality and the shadows of reality, and so on and so forth. Most of them end up in the morass of relativism, which systemically is self-defeating. The morass of relativism, which systemically is self-defeating. So I want to see, present to you, why I believe the Judeo-Christian worldview has, in my way of thinking, that coherence and that correspondence. And I take you through four thoughts, and in a rare moment of pre-preparation, I did send in an outline. So it is there with you. The first one is this. In the Judeo-Christian worldview, I'm not going to focus on the particulars. We can interact on that gladly. I'm focusing on the grand model and the big picture, that God created humanity. And the God I'm referring to is the God of the Old and the New Testaments, whose character I think will unfold in what it is I want to present. Now, the problem is I think we get sidetracked into the minutiae here. We start crossing our T's and dotting our I's in a way that maybe creates more dissonance and creates more questions in the footnotes, missing the main script of this story. And so we've lost in the process the marvel and the wonder of what this is all about. The story is told of a man who was watching another man fish. And he saw every time he caught a big fish, he threw that fish back into the water. When he caught a tiny little one, put it into his bag. Another big one back into the water, a tiny little one into his bag. Finally, rather perplexed by this, went on and said to him, "Can you please explain to me why you're throwing the big ones away?" He says, "Because I only have an 8-inch frying pan. And anything bigger than 8 inches doesn't fit my frying pan." And in this highly naturalistic, materialistic, anti-miraculous 8-inch frame of reference that we've created for ourselves, we have missed the miracle. We've missed the marvel. And you can be absolutely sure the naturalist smuggles his or her miracle in at the right points. The idea of the gaps is not the private possession of the theistic worldview. The gaps are there in every major worldview. The question is, does the paradigm fit and have enough reason behind it to see how these gaps might actually be filled? So rather than the 8-inch frying pan model, I would like to take for you a different model. It is this. If you left a glass of water on your desk when you left home in the morning with 4 ounces in it and went away for the day, and you came back at the end of the day and you saw 8 ounces of water in it, you may conclude that when you left there, there were 2 glasses on that desk. One had 4 ounces, and there was another glass there, that somebody may have taken water from glass B and poured it into glass A to make it 8. But you do remember, when you left, the glass B had 4 ounces and glass A was empty. So wherever the 4 ounces added water came from, it had to come from somewhere else. You're not questioning that there's 8 ounces in there. The question is, where did the extra 4 ounces come from? And so while certain worldviews may explain the 4 ounces within their own framework, the other 4 ounces have to find another source for explanation, because glass B has 8 ounces, glass A had 0 when you left, and now you have to explain the difference of where the 4 ounces came from. And so what I think we have to do is plainly try to understand this extra 4 ounces. When I was studying under Dr. John Polkinghorne, the noted quantum physicist at Cambridge, a close friend of Stephen Hawking, Dr. Polkinghorne was at that time president of Queen's College, Cambridge, one of the world's leading quantum physicists. And this man, very diminutive in size, a late comer to faith in Christ himself. Some of you, I'm sure, have read his book, One World, and some of his other works. His book, Quantum, is hailed by Physics Bulletin as one of the finest in his genre. Dr. Pokinghorn one day was looking at us in the class, and he started talking about the early contingencies in the picoseconds of the early framework of the universe. And he made just one comment at this point. In his book, he gives several. He says, think of just the relationship between the expansion and the contraction forces. One contingency, right at the beginning of the formation of the universe. He says, how finely tuned it had to be, and how the margin of error had to be so small. He said, to quote another metaphysician, he said, putting it in perspective, the exactitude demanded would be something akin to taking aim at a 1 square inch object at the other end of the universe, 20 billion light years away, and hitting it bullseye. Pokinghorn, in typical English understatement, walked over towards the window, turned his back to all of us, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Somebody has to pay. Somebody has to pay. It is not uncommon for you to walk into a particular church, St. Bartholomew's in Cambridge today on a Sunday morning, and see Stephen Hawking himself being wheeled in there by his own terms, maybe on my own spiritual pilgrimage. This hunger that goes on and on and on, even with the search and the fulfillment of knowledge. And so when God created humanity, we see two implications of that. Number one is that there is implicit worth in every human being. This is intrinsic value, not extrinsic value. This is intrinsic value to every human being. Every man, woman, and child is of essential value, not given by fiat or not given by some benevolent constitution or taken away by some demagogue. It is of intrinsic value to human life. That is the implication of the Creator and the created, that you and I have essential worth, and you desacralize that worth and you step onto a slippery slope of devaluing everything in the process. You know, Jesus many times questioned his questioners so that he would open them up within their own assumptions. One comes to him and is trying a trick question. Is it all right to pay taxes to Caesar? Many times I have wished Jesus had answered that differently. Especially as we come to April 15th. Jesus brilliantly responded. He said, have you got a coin on you? I said, yeah, give me that coin. He says, whose image do you see on this coin? He says, Caesar. He says, give to Caesar that which is Caesar's. The questioner betrayed his own prejudice, because Jesus' second point to the answer was, and give to God that which is God's. Do you know what the questioner should have asked next? What belongs to God? I would have asked that. And I think I know what Jesus would have said. Whose image is on you? The image on the coin is Caesar's. Give to Caesar that which is Caesar's. Whose image do you bear? Do you know the Judeo-Christian worldview is the only worldview that holds to that? That you're made in the image of God? The Muslim would consider that blasphemous. The Hindu will not accept that, because the caste system is intrinsic to his or her faith, where every birth is a rebirth. And an accretion of karma from the previous birth is now embodied in yours. Buddhism, a variant of that, but same idea. When you and I are told that we are made in the image of God, the implication is very obvious. We are created with essential worth. But there was a second trick question. The second trick question given to Jesus is, which is the greatest law? You see, first he's pitching power against power, Caesar against God. Now the questioner is pitching law against law. Brilliant. Which is the greatest law? Because in the Mosaic corpus, there were 613 laws. David reduced them to 15. Isaiah brought them down to 11. Micah brought them down to 3. To do justice, love mercy, and to walk humbly before your God. I would have liked Jesus to reduce it to 1, but he didn't. He reduced it to 2. Because they are inextricable. to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul and all your strength, and to love as your neighbor as yourself. On these two, he said, hang all of the law and the prophets, because the first logically leads to the second. The second would stand in midair if it weren't connected to the first. The value of human life: you love your neighbor as yourself because your neighbor is as of equal value before God. Think of this for a moment. We all would find reprehensible the idea of racism. Can I ask you how naturalism leads to that? I don't have the mind of a Francis Collins. I don't have the musical ability of a Johann Sebastian Bach. I don't have the running ability of a Justin Gatlin. We are not equal in our skills. And it was the atheist Nietzsche who said that. Listen to what he says. Equality is a lie concocted by the inferior people who arrange themselves in herds to overpower those who are naturally superior to them. The morality of equal rights is herd mentality, because it opposes the cultivation of superior individuals. It leads to the corruption of the human species. That was Nietzsche, the atheist, who said, don't give me this equality bit. Nietzsche was a naturalist, and he was taking the logical outworking of naturalism. It is only if you and I are created by a transcendent, perfect being, that the bequest of that being is your essential worth and the rightful pride of every ethnic group in this world, which is exactly what the Apostle Paul said to those on Mars Hill. He is not far from any one of us, though he from beforehand has determined where each one of us should live. You have a right to the pride of your ethnicity, as I have a right to the pride of mine. That is not naturalism's bequest. That is the bequest of a transcendent moral order. And so I say to you, the first implication, intrinsic worth. The second implication is reflective splendor. Not only is there intrinsic worth, but there's reflective splendor. I've written several books on imaginary conversations between Jesus and, one was called The Lotus and the Cross, Jesus Talks to Buddha. Second one was an imaginary conversation between Jesus and Oscar Wilde, Sense and Sensuality. The third one that was recently released was The Lamb and the Führer, Jesus Talks to Adolf Hitler. And when you look at the story of what Hitler unleashed upon the world, and by the way, he stood on the shoulders of Nietzsche. He personally presented Nietzsche's writings to Mussolini and Stalin, because he believed in the Superman and the super race. When I walked through Buchenwald and Dachau and Auschwitz, and thought back of what I saw there, one of the most pitiful stories was a woman at Buchenwald who had snuck out of her cabin early one morning to find food. And she was digging in the grass to pick up some worms. And suddenly she saw this horrific figure looking at her through a window. She said it looked devilish, looked heinous. And I moved away quickly and then realized that figure was at that next window too. She said it finally dawned on me. It was my reflection that I was looking at. That's what they'd done to her. The splendor was gone. The reflection was horrible. Nietzsche said, when we find out that God has died in the 19th century, the 20th century will become the bloodiest century in history, and universal madness would break out. He took the first step and spent 13 years of his last years in an insane asylum himself. We dehumanized man. The splendor was gone. And so I say to you, the created order is a very important one. Viktor Frankl said this: if we present man with a concept of man which is not true, we may well corrupt him. When we present him as an automaton of reflexes, as a mind machine, as a bundle of instincts, as a pawn of drives and reactions, as a mere product of heredity and environment, we will then feed the nihilism to which modern man is in any case prone. I became acquainted with the last stage of corruption in my second concentration camp, Auschwitz. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazi liked to say, of blood and soil. I'm absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some Ministry of Defense or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. Tough words. The logical outworking of nihilism. So first is the creation. God created man. The second is the incarnation. that it was not just that God created the humanity, but that God actually took on the flesh, as it were. The Apostle Paul says, being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, took upon himself the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of humanity. Being found then in fashion as a human being, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death. And the story goes on. In the Greek metaphor, John says, the Logos, the Word, became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. As that truth is accepted by us in the Judeo-Christian worldview, then there are two logical implications that actually follow. The first is this: the absoluteness of the moral law. The absoluteness of the moral law. And ladies and gentlemen, as tough as this is to understand, metaphysicians, ethicists are coming to the conclusion that if you don't have a point of reference for a moral law, can you really say there is any such thing as evil anymore? Listen to the words of Kai Nielsen and then later on to Richard Dawkins, who also teaches at Oxford. Kai Nielsen, the Canadian, says this as an atheist: I have not been able to show that reason requires the moral point of view, or that really rational persons, unhoodwinked by myth or ideology, need not be individual egoists or classical amoralists. Reason just doesn't decide here. The picture I have painted for you is not a pleasant one. Bertrand Russell said, in fact, it's a depressing one. He says, reflection on it depresses me too. Pure practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, that will not take you to morality. That's why a day or two before Einstein died, he and Bertrand Russell issued a joint statement in which they said, those of us who know the most are the most pessimistic about the future. Because reason does not require a moral point of view. There is no basic rational principle to justify why one culture's morality is superior to another culture's morality. They have their own defense mechanisms. And so Bin Laden will call us wicked, we will call him evil. What is the metaphysical backdrop against which we make this judgment? Listen to what J.L. Mackey, one of the most vociferous atheists, has said. He says this: we might well argue that objective, intrinsically prescriptive features supervenient upon natural ones constitute so odd a cluster of qualities and relations that they're most unlikely to have arisen in any ordinary course of events without an all-powerful God to create them. So Mackey says that, Nielsen says that, it is not rationally possible to arrive at it other than from a self-preservation motif, which is not self-justifying if you are the stronger. Why should a weaker be preserved? Listen, therefore, to what Dawkins has said. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. That's Dawkins. I was at Oxford recently when one of his proteges was debating the mimic theory, that religion is part of a meme which needs to be expunged before it destroys us. That's Dawkins. I present to you the fact, the moral law, which is so compelling and so impelling within. Do you know what the Ten Commandments tells me? That my life is sacred, your life is sacred. My property is sacred, your property is sacred. My word ought to be sacred, your word ought to be sacred. Time is sacred. Your neighbor's marriage is sacred. You do not violate it. You do not kill. Life is sacred at its core. And now we do not want to be reminded of that. We live under the illusion of neutrality. I've lived in the West now 30 years of my life, and the previous time lived being raised in India. I want to tell you this. You may not like what I'm going to say. I'm going to say it. At this stage of my life, I sleep just as soundly if somebody gets upset with me. America is flirting with extinction because America has lost the metaphysical backdrop against which its constitution was framed. It is fleeing from it. And I'll tell you what, there are counter-religious perspectives in this world that find naked secularism no threat to them at all. They'll push it over. The only worldview that can withstand another transcendent worldview is a worldview that is transcendent and true, that has the moral strength and moral courage behind it. So the absoluteness of the moral law, and secondly and quickly the implication, the supremacy of love. It is the supremacy of love. You know, I was talking to a prominent Olympian. I shall not give you any more details than that. He had gone beyond what he ever thought he was going to go beyond. He, from the time he was 12, his goal was to win the gold medal. And he finally got to the Olympics. And it was an incredible feat. It was all over the newspapers. And his final run was going to be telecast and billions were going to be watching it. He came to my office in Atlanta to spend a morning with me. And he flew many, many hours to get there. Tough, solid-looking athlete. He sat across the table. I did not expect to hear what I was going to hear. He said, "I'm empty on the inside, having won the medal that I did." He said, "In my final run, in a split second before the gun was sounded, the question on my heart was one, is my dad watching?" He said, "Because I was alienated from my father, and he told me I'd never account to anything. Now I was about to run for the gold." He said, "And the only thought in my mind is my daddy watching." And this big guy, the tears start running down his face. He said, "I lost a stride at the gunshot. And I ended up with a bronze medal. I should have won the gold." But he said, "I'm not here to talk about that. I want you to help me. How do I reconcile with my dad?" When I was speaking in Qatar, Doha, to our troops at CENTCOM for the worldwide war on terrorism, they lined up to shake hands with me. The most powerfully equipped military in the world. You know what they were saying to me? "Can you call my mom when you get back? Can you call my dad? Can you call my wife? Tell her I love her." The supremacy of love. So when the Bible says, God so loved that he gave, I want you to think for a moment at the crucial moment in the Christian faith, at the cross, when history was finding its intersection, he looks at a young man and points to his mother and says, "Take care of her." He says to her, "It's your son." God's love is something we desperately need. And the more we run from it, we strip ourselves of all that the world really longs for. Bertrand Russell said, "Of all the pursuits in life, the one thing I never found was love." You're impoverished when you don't have it. And so God becoming man is that paradigm. Thirdly and quickly, first, God creating humanity. Secondly, taking on the form of humanity. Thirdly, the transformation. The transformation is very straightforward, that what he really says in the end is that the human heart is desperately wicked, and needs to be transformed. You know, I come from the land of India. My ancestors were the highest caste of the Hindu priesthood. And I came from a very sophisticated background of linguists. My grandfather was the first professor of English appointed by the British in the University in Madras. My dad was a powerful man in the State Department, and language came very easily to my ancestors, but they were also priests. And it was a day that came into my life almost like the Platonic philosopher who cried out saying, "All these shadows are great, but I want to touch a face." I wanted to find that personal relationship, and I found it in Christ on a bed of suicide when I was 17. And I want to say to you that that relationship of what God changes is not so much that exterior, which is all right and easy to do, it's that interior, where he changes what you hunger, what you long for. And now after 3 decades of crisscrossing this globe, I hear it not one time, not 2 times, not 3 times, not 100 times. I've heard it thousands of times. My wife and I were in one country that I shall leave unnamed, where a young man from the Iraqi army who said he was trained to do 2 things, to make false passports and to kill without feelings. To kill without feelings. He just submitted his life to Christ and contacted me and said, "Can I talk to you alone?" And when he told us the story of over lunch, and he told us how it happened through dreams and visions at night and Christ appearing to him, he said, "This was my only hope. My mother told me to get out of the country. I got out for 7 years in a row every night, that same dream, this haunting presence of Christ." That's within their cultural framework. And he'd become a follower of Christ. I said, "What are your plans?" He said, "I'm studying now to go back to Iraq." I said, "How do you plan to get back there?" He said, "I make passports to get back." Some part of him still needed changing, I guess. But you know the transformation. But is not secularist coming to the same idea so that I can move to my last thought? Here's what Daniel Yankelevich said after serving scores of people and scores of couples about America's search for meaning. He ends it by saying, if you feel it is imperative to fill all your needs, and if these needs are contradictory or in conflict with those of others or simply unfillable, then frustration inevitably follows. To Abby and to Mark as well, self-fulfillment means having a career and marriage and children and sexual freedom and autonomy and being liberal and having money and choosing nonconformity and insisting on social justice and enjoying city life and country living and simplicity and graciousness and reading and good friends and on and on. He said, but the individual is not truly fulfilled by becoming ever more autonomous. Indeed, to move too far in this direction is to risk psychosis, the ultimate form of autonomy. And then he ends by saying this, the injunction that to find oneself one must lose oneself contains the truth any seeker of self-fulfillment needs to grasp. They could have saved millions of dollars in this research if they'd read the Gospel of John. To find oneself, one must lose oneself is a truth we need to understand. And so the transformation that in dying you live, and the second implication, in surrendering, you win. You know, I've been to Mahatma Gandhi's home in Ahmedabad, and I was stunned by a banner outside. Mahatma Gandhi was a Hindu, although he carried a New Testament all his life and has had fascinating comments on the person of Christ, especially on the cross, and his most enigmatic thing he'd ever read in any worldview. But outside Gandhi's home is a banner, a shocking banner, in the words of Bertrand Russell, who was an atheist. It is doubtful that the Mahatma's method would have succeeded, except he was appealing to the conscience of a Christianized people. How do you like that? It is doubtful that the Mahatma's method would have succeeded, except he was appealing to the conscience of a Christianized people. So here's an atheist talking about a pantheist who succeeded because of a Christianized conscience. Inescapable, isn't it? Inescapable. How nonviolence worked against a powerful empire, because the Christianized conscience believes, billion below, just rose to the fore and said, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. So you find creation, incarnation, transformation, lastly, consummation. What does it mean to be human? It means to recognize the diversity you and I have within us. And what we need is the search for unity, which was the greatest search by the big three, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, which is why, by the way, universities were created to find unity in diversity, which is why we have on our coins a pluribus unum, out of the many one, which is why the word quintessence was coined, because the four essences of earth, air, water, fire did not satisfy what is the quintessence of life, fifth essence that unites these essences. I will suggest to you, it is worship. It is worship. The Archbishop of Canterbury said this, worship is the quickening of conscience by His Holiness. It is the submission of all of our nature to God. The quickening of conscience by His Holiness, nourishment of mind by His truth, purifying of imagination by His beauty, opening of the heart to His love, and submission of will to His purpose. All this gathered up in adoration is the greatest expression of which we are capable. Quickening of conscience by His Holiness, mind by His truth, imagination by His beauty, heart to His love and will to His purpose. All this gathered up in adoration is the greatest expression of which you are capable. No matter how ruggedly materialistic we become, we will never kill the urge to worship in humanity. So we'd better find out what it is to worship in spirit and in truth, or we'll be worshiping with the flesh and with a lie. Coherence inside is what the unity and diversity is all about, and you find it now. So we don't make decisions ad hoc. There has to be a fence somewhere. There has to be a fence somewhere that you can't have limitless knowledge moving with the limitless boundaries. There has to be, Chesterton once said, anytime you remove any fence, always pause long enough to find out why it was put there in the first place. Unity and diversity within, and finally, diversity in community. Then, when we come face to face with our God Himself. I close with two quick illustrations. The Canadian writer Douglas Coupland has a book called Life After God. He's a Gen Xer, and he wanted to abandon God and decided he would. But at the end he said, I've come to the conclusion I still need Him. I don't know how, but I need Him. But at one point he tells a story of him walking through a botanical garden, and he heard some voices, and he saw a group of blind women who were out for the day in a botanical garden. And then all of a sudden one of them said, "Am I hearing somebody here?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am, I'm here, but it's okay, no, I'm just walking by." She said, "Sir, would you do us a favor?" He said, "Yes. Would you take a photograph of us?" And for a moment he put his head back. He thought to himself, "Is this a joke or what?" And so one woman rummages in her purse, takes out a camera and gives it to him, and they all come next to each other, positioning themselves. He helps them. And he takes that photograph and he walks away scratching his head, thinking, "What was that about? Do you know what it's about?" They'd probably go and get that picture developed, and they'd show it to somebody with eyes. And that somebody with eyes will tell them what they were wearing and what they looked like, because they themselves will remember what they felt and who they were with. I'm convinced when we stand face to face with God and look at this world through His eyes, it'll all make sense. He'll tell us what we look like, and the reflection will be glorious that He made us in His own image, and we'll remember what we felt and who we were with, and finally it will all come together. Dr. Polkinghorne ends his science book, One World, The Interaction of Science and Theology, with this incredible statement. Please let me read it to you. It's a couple of paragraphs. "I'm sorry I don't use PowerPoint. I'm not smart enough for that. I still trust him for the power, and I try to make the point, and hopefully you got some of it here." Okay, here's the closing paragraphs by Dr. Polkinghorne. "Reality is a multi-layered unity. I can't perceive another person as an aggregation of atoms, an open biochemical system in interaction with the environment, a specimen of Homo sapiens, an object of beauty, someone who needs and deserves my respect and compassion, and yes, as a brother for whom Jesus Christ died. All are true, and all mysteriously cohere in that one person. To deny any one of these levels is to diminish both that person and myself, the perceiver, to do less than justice to the richness of reality. Part of the case for theism that in God the Creator, the source of all being, these different levels find their lodging and their guarantee. He is the source of connection, the one whose creative act holds in one the worldviews of science, aesthetics, ethics, and religion, as expressions of His reason, joy, will, and presence. This interlocking character of the world of creation," listen now please, "finds its fullest expression in the concept of sacrament, an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace, a wonderful fusion of the concerns of science and theology. Thus in the Eucharist bread and wine, which in the words of the liturgy, earth has given and human hands have made, become then the body and blood of Christ, the source of spiritual life. The greatest sacrament, compared to which all others are types and shadows, is the incarnation, in which the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth, and we beheld His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father." You know, the word logos combines two notions, one Greek and one Hebrew. For the Greek, logos was the rational ordering principle of the universe. For the Hebrew, the word of the Lord was God's activity in the world. For the Hebrew word davar means both word and deed. Hebrew is a language based on verbs and action. Science discerns a world of rational order, developing through the unfolding of process, a fusion of Greek and Hebrew thoughts. Theology declares that the world in its scientific character to be an expression of the Word of God. For all things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. May we find our Maker and find out who we are. Thank you so much. God bless you.